is Theological Reflections on Hope and Healing, and my name is Norma Jean Sturman. I think it's fascinating to see who comes to what sessions at Holden. Usually you pick a session for a reason, or what expectations you'd like to have dealt with today. Anybody want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I was thinking that, I realized that I'm grieving a lot, and my tendency is to repress the pain and the grieving. So the title was like, I know that people say that if you grieve and you go through that, it's the beginning of healing, and I don't believe in that. So I really hope that by grieving, I might just get to a place where, I feel comfortable mm-hmm, mm-hmm. with whatever I'm dealing with.
Okay, thank you. Good point. We all tend to, our natural human tendency, I think, is to repress and to not talk about. That's also been a theme I've been dealing with, is that to be able to bring our pain to speech is the beginning of healing. And mysteriously, the cross, the mystery of death and resurrection, I think, is very much involved. Anybody else want to?
Well, about 15 years ago, I had glomerular nephritis. And the doctor said that, according to all the literature, I would not make it. And but through the prayers of our friends all over the country, it turned out that my case was the most dramatic turnaround in nephritis history.
So through prayer, you believe that.
Mm-hmm. And when I tried to thank the doctor, he said, "Don't thank me."
Interesting. Thanks. Okay. Other beginning points? What do you want to say? Yeah.
I've wondered sometimes, I know you've talked here too in sessions about the importance of talking out one's grief mm-hmm. and being open about it. Can there come a time when there gets to be endless reaction of the stuff mm-hmm. that is not healthy?
Oh, yes. And that's something that's very difficult to describe about what I believe happens in the groups that I lead, in terms of what kind of a process you're involved in. To take the example of a grief group, to talk out your grief, the stereotype that a lot of people have about a grief group is that's what you do. You just sit around and talk about your sad stories, and then you just keep talking about them. And what did you say?
Everybody gets more depressed.
Yeah, right, and everybody gets dragged down. And yes, I think that the point of bringing pain to speech, as Matthew Fox says, is so we can let it go. But if we don't bring it to speech, it will come out in a variety of projections, all kinds of psychological studies on that, health things, who knows all what. So I believe that's a very good point, that there's a very much of a healing process that I believe comes through other people, through very skilled and gifted leadership of a group that can know how to move people on. And I believe that comes through dealing with it through your spirituality. That's a big question. We could talk a lot about how that could be done, but that involves group facilitation. But I think is that speaking to your question at all? Yeah, because I think I know of a lot of grief groups, and even in many conversations up here these past 2 weeks, have talked to people that have gone to grief groups that are highly clinical, that just deal with, here are the stages, and this is what happens when you're in grief. And that is not life-giving after the first session. I mean, you can know all that. And there's a very huge difference, I think, between intellectual understanding of what you're dealing with and then your whole emotional systems mm-hmm. clicking in. And so I think it's very much a process that I think needs to be with other people, i.e. either one-to-one counseling, therapy, spiritual direction, or group that deals with spirituality. And I can just say, some of the tape segments I've shown, and I'm over and over again, what I'm doing now is videotaping people that have been in my groups to have them process what's been happening to them. And a lot of them will say, I'm not sure what all this was. It's a mystery, I think. But what it happens over and over again when people are in community, they come together around their grief issues, but then it does not stay stuck there at all. It goes into life, because that's the embracing the contrary that we're involved in. It's constantly this tension between life and death, and that we may come together over a need, over a grief issue, but then it spills into all of the rest of our life. And if that can be introduced in the tension of our faith walk, which is another contrary, then it's put in the tension of life. Other comments? Okay, well, I'll just do some presenting of what I prepared for today, and then we can have some more discussion about that. That's a good introductory question that you asked, Ruth, because of what I wanted to first say about this topic, theological reflection on hope and healing, I think I've already said, is that our hope and healing comes out of whatever our faith base is. And I think there are a variety of ways that we can find that, which I've already mentioned. One is an in-depth community, which is a group experience. One of the things about teaching up here is you feel like you don't know if you're repeating yourself because you don't know who's been to your other sessions, but some of you haven't been here, I can see. So I'll just quickly tell you that one in-depth experience I had, I was talking to several people out of session about this, is a women's support group, I guess, I don't like that word support group because it's kind of getting a bad name. It's like, oh, everybody's got to have a support group for every little thing. But a women's group, I'll say, where we came together out of a mutual interest, actually, and need in exploring where we were at as feminist Christian women. So we started out reading a book together, and, well, actually, I'd read a book and pass out notes, kind of like a college seminar, and then everybody would read a book. It was wonderful. And I very much believe, and that's why I believe in the group, which is another answer to your question, Ruth, to be studying something in common, or to be coming together where you've been reading something in common, then we have all these stories in every chapter that we've all fed on that week. So we did that, and then, not this book, other books. And then after about 4 weeks of doing that, we realized we had so much to explore together that we went unstructured. We didn't use a book. And we would use the technique of go-around, which, so say we were here today as one group, everybody has their sort of airspace to talk about whatever their issues are. And maybe you didn't have a whole lot to say that day, but maybe your next door person sitting next to you really needed to, and they could have the whole time if they wanted to. And the therapeutic effect of that is you have five, or however small group, I think, five at the most, six total, people who are listening to you, drawing you out, caring about you. So then when it's the next person's turn, their issues are spinning off of the other issues. It's an amazing process. It's very much the process of liberation theology. And I believe that's a very liberating process for anybody to be in, men, women, mixed groups, or whatever. It happened to be all women for me. And that radicalized my notion of what community is. So it's the process I use in the grief groups that I lead. And that group went for 2 years every Saturday for breakfast. We started a breakfast meeting. 2 hours for 2 years. And those are my soul sisters. I am bonded to them in an incredible way. I feel energy from them, even if I don't, I've moved away now. I don't live around any of them. But I think that is a model of what Christian community can be. And it's one of my passions for this kind of issue in the parish, let's say. That if people could come around an issue, it doesn't even really matter what the issue is, I think community can be formed very, very deeply. And then what happens is there's so much energy. All the literature that I've been reading verifies that too, that shared pain gives energy, which is a mystery of the cross, mm-hmm. I believe, death and resurrection. Then, when you go into another community, you still have that energy that it empowers you to form other kinds of communities, one-to-one communities or group communities or whatever. So, that is one way to do theological reflection on hope and healing, for instance, is to do it in a committed group. And one of the things I do in the groups I lead is we contract for committed attendance, so everybody's there. You don't go shopping or do something other than come to the group, you know. And so if we're all there, you can build some trust and community. And then what happens every time after we've met for our first 8 weeks, we realize we're just starting a very exciting adventure of getting to know each other, and we've contracted for another 8 weeks, and then it's gone. Now each group that I've started like this has gone to meeting once a month. So there's ongoing connections. And we're not dealing with death. Or we're giving baby showers for this woman that's having a baby. And I mean, it's all kinds of exciting community. So I think it's a nice model for a small group community within a large group situation. I think, so what I'm trying to say is that one way we do theological reflection is one-to-one relationships. It happens a lot at Holden, one-to-one conversations everywhere. A group which then turns into a long-term relationship. And as I'm getting older, I realize that the strength I draw upon is my old relationships. People that know me from many, that know my history, that know my parents, that know my life story. And I live in Minnesota, and luckily almost everybody that I know for long term still lives there or fairly close to there. And I really draw heavily on those relationships for theological reflection. I really also believe that retreat, and there are so many forms and varieties. We're here at Holden, which is one kind of retreat, and I find I have to embrace the contrary at Holden of I get very sad every day that bus leaves, even if I don't know everybody really well that was on the bus. But it's the contrary of meeting angels, as I say. You know, you can be out here and meet someone and have an incredible conversation. Maybe they are the person you needed for right then. You may never see them again, but that's also a way I think we do theological reflection. And I envy, in a way, the people that are here on long-term staff and have the two-year commitment or the longer time commitment. Part of the work I do is we go on retreat. At the end of each 8 or 16 week session, we go on retreat and are led by another facilitator, and that's a wonderful, another vista. Also the concept of having a spiritual director, which I have learned from the Roman Catholic tradition, which ideally is, I think, what a pastor is set up to do in the Protestant tradition, except I see pastors getting tugged and pulled in so many various and sundry directions, like administration and who knows all what they have to do. But the idea of having a spiritual director with whom you can go process your life. It's not, see, therapy is a word that I think needs a lot of definition. I mean, it is therapy. It's very therapeutic, but so is education very therapeutic. Friendship is therapeutic. But I have been very, very fortunate and blessed on my journey to have been introduced to the Roman Catholic tradition of contemplation and retreat. They have a very strong tradition of that. So I have two very special Catholic sisters who serve that function for me. And I've decided it's one of my positive addictions. I can't get along without it anymore. Just someone to process my life. And that's the way I do my theological reflection, in one of the ways. All of these ways I've mentioned, I think, are some methods of doing theological reflection. We're all born into families. Family systems we've been raised with, we've been born in, that parents either brought us to church or didn't bring us to church, to a certain kind of church, and then we get to be, you know, maybe our late teens and early 20s, and we have to sort it out for ourselves. And then as we go along, all of our life events thrust us into asking new questions, and we leave one denomination to find life in another denomination, and all of that's part of doing theological reflection. Any more comments you'd like to make on methods of doing theological reflection before I get into some of the content? Yes?
Asking too many questions.
No, I love it.
Could you explain a little more how the use of the relationship of the spiritual director works?
Mm-hmm. Well, my experience with it has been... my first experience was being invited by another friend at a time of real pain in my life and disorientation. I didn't know what I was going through. I didn't understand it. I needed some words for it. She invited me to go to a prayer retreat. And I attended this prayer retreat, which was a day-long retreat in an Episcopal center, I remember. And this sister would just, the format of the retreat was, her gift is to lead people through imaging Bible parables, Bible stories. So you would just sit in a circle like this, and she asks you to close your eyes, for instance, and would take you through, read the Bible story, but as she would go through, would embellish it with being there yourself. For instance, I've learned through that kind of process to be the woman at the well, which is my favorite Bible story, you know, to be that woman and to sit there at the well and have Jesus look into my eyes and to know my reality. So in other words, we're really putting ourselves into the stories, which is very different from the tradition I grew up in, which was that these were stories long ago, and maybe or maybe not, I could figure out what they had to do with my life. So it's a very embodied way I have experienced of being introduced to scripture. And then, so we would experience her leading us through this meditation, and in a sense, you feel like you've been on a trip. You've been back there. You've been, and Jesus is very present with you. And then the other technique or style she would use was just to go off and spend a lot of time alone, listening to what was coming from inside of you, listening to your surroundings, to do some journaling, and then come back, share some of it with the group. Not a lot of that. It was, the focus was on being alone, being led through scripture, and then asking, what is this saying to me? And then I realized that this was so life-giving for me that I wanted more of that. So I asked her if I could talk with her privately, and when I did, then she does a lot of private consultation or direction with people during the quiet spaces in the retreat as well. And that started me in a very, very exciting relationship with her, where every retreat she would come to our town, she lived about 4 hours away, to do retreats. And then my husband saw how exciting it was for me, so he started going to her for private direction, and she became like our pastor. And then when we moved to a different town, I couldn't see her as much, so I realized I needed the physical presence of another spiritual director. So I was introduced to another Catholic sister who was a feisty Irish woman. And the first one I met was a very different personality, and they served very different functions for me at different points in my life because of their personalities. And now she's in my hometown, and I have a very informal contractual relationship with her where I just call her up whenever I'd like to talk with her. And I go in and meet with her and process my life with her. Just I journal issues that I'm stuck on or I need movement with. And it's very much the role of a pastor-priest, I think, in a congregation. Is that speaking to something about what it is? It takes many, many forms, but anybody else has had that similar journey or want to say anything about that? I think, it's essential in terms of theological reflection. It gets into the whole issue of being contemplative in a very fragmented, distracted world. I mean, my daily life, I guess I, as a psychologist, would say I'm allowing this to happen to me. But I think we all feel very fragmented and pulled by all the demands. And I think it's a discipline. It's very much a discipline, I think, to take time out, to go to a retreat on a Saturday when you could think of. But for me, that's become the top priority now. I would rather do that than do almost any other thing because I need it. And then there's that whole Myers-Briggs, is that the way, saying that right? A way of, different personalities find it in different ways too. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, I think people that are that are not as process oriented, for instance, as my personality, there are a lot of people that wouldn't have that need to go into that. Some people, extroverts, I'm sort of right on the line. I can go either way, but as I understand that sort of measurement of personalities, introverts are recharged by being alone. Mm-hmm. Extroverts tend to be recharged by being with people. And you have to sort of know your need. You know, you have to need to know, like Jesus, when to withdraw from being with people and when to go nurture yourself, and then when you're called to be there for other people, it's a balance again.
So you mean you took this test and you thought it was helpful? Because I've heard of it and I thought it was
helpful in understanding myself.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
I'll comment on that. I've taken that test and I'm an ISXJ. And has opened new worlds to me in understanding myself.
Yeah, I think it's very helpful.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And there's a whole body of literature coming out of the Roman Catholic tradition, primarily on that. Who We Are Is How We Pray is one of the books. Have you read that?
I've seen that.
Yeah. In other words, understanding what you're like helps you understand how you pray and how you seek out theological reflection or spiritual direction. And,
yeah, I've done some of these retreats, but and I think that the meditation, I mean, to, it's not meditation which you contemplation. But if you don't have a follow-up, I mean, some kind of guidance afterwards, what's the difference? I mean, I do that on a daily basis, every second of my life. I keep thinking and thinking, and the internal child never shuts up, unfortunately. So, I understand what you're talking. I think it's a beautiful concept of processing all that, and just not have it sitting there.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't know what to do with a lot interesting thoughts or interesting things.
Yes.
But I could go in many, many directions. And it's really interesting to see that maybe there's some, I mean, you can process things with the help of other people.
Yes. My sister friends that have introduced me to this too, you know, there's a tradition when you're training to be a spiritual director, going on 30-day silent retreats. In the Catholic tradition, where you literally are silent, you don't talk at meals. It's a whole discipline in the Catholic order of contemplatives. It's very, very fascinating. And just those little bits of retreat in my life, contemplative, has shaped what I want out of worship. Believe it or not, I think I'm becoming more introverted as I get older, but I don't, this is just a personal opinion, I don't like to shake hands and do all. When I come to worship now, it's like I like to come into a very holy, sacred, quiet space with stained glass windows and candles, and have a lot of silence in the service and to meditate. That's what I need for worship. I don't like standing up, sitting down, shaking hands with people. That's just has influenced my style of worship. Now that's just very, very highly personal, okay? Because and part of that is like when you're a young mother. In church, which has been my experience in my early life, early mothering, I felt like I was in a wrestling match during church, you know? So,
and you know, yet they say that's the problem with Lutherans.
What is?
That you know, they're not enough shaking hands and slapping on the back. And I don't agree. I agree with you. I much prefer the quieter type of worship.
Yes.
I mean, I understand. I like being in meditation. I belong to a group. I mean, to this Teze style prayer, and we do a lot of meditation there. It's really nice. But I guess that worshiping with other people and be joyful together is also a nice experience.
It's just a statement on how we all need very different things and find it in very different places. And like you were saying, the argument there is that you know, Lutheran, they're not friendly in that church and all that kind of thing. And, I don't know. So I think that's another piece on that. We have to find all of the different things we need in different places. And not if we know what we need and then you go into a certain place to find it and it isn't there, that you think, well, maybe I'm looking in the wrong place and maybe I need to look somewhere else. Okay. I'd like to just present some ideas that I've gleaned from some of my reading that I thought fit nicely into this topic, this category for today. Do some of you receive or are familiar with the publication called Weavings? It's a wonderful journal that comes out, I think, like 3 or 4 times a year. And I find the articles like really in depth, which is why I like it. So I'm going to just present 2 different articles that I found that I thought fit this topic. And the first one, one of the sessions I gave last week was called Living with What We Cannot Fix. And when I was presenting that, I found this letter in the Weavings Journal from June 89, entitled From a Letter to a Friend by a man named Stephen Bryant. And I didn't have time to present it the day I gave that particular session, so I'm going to present that now, and then we can have, please interrupt, or we'll have time to discuss it. And I think this has to do with theological reflection, hope, and healing. This was a letter that he wrote to a friend who had had an incredible loss, and he was writing a letter of friendship and consolation. And for what, there were many things about the letter that I thought were wonderful, including the fact that he started out saying, I can't imagine how this must be for you. I've never had this experience. I don't know how you feel, but. and then goes on to write the letter, as opposed to, I know just exactly how you feel, da-da-da-da, which is what oftentimes we find ourselves saying when we mean well. But he starts out with this whole thing of our brokenness and being broken into, and his point is that our own personal losses are really crucibles in which our lives are reshaped. And I really believe that's true. I experience that myself and with the work I do with people, because oftentimes what I hear when you document, what you hear people say is, well, it wasn't until my father died that I began to ask, or it wasn't until this horrible accident that I realized, so that events come along to shape our lives and thrust us into asking questions we never had to ask before, which is part of the crucible of our own personal experience. So then he goes on in this letter to his friend about questions of God's will, and he said, whatever, I'm just reinterpreting, whatever the brokenness or loss, he was referring to the specific situation, it is God's will that, first of all, God is passionately in love with us and the creation. You know, again, well-meaning people say, well, this, I'm sure this was God's will. God wanted this person well. That does not comfort us most of the time. Comfort some people, but. Also that God is willing to give God's self with complete abandon for our good, as God has done in the creation and in Jesus. And that God is a lover, and God has surrendered and continues to surrender God's advantage to become as we are. That's the kind of God we have. We do not have a despot God who is a fix-it God or a know-it-all God. We have a God who is a lover God, who has strength of love to share our struggles, as opposed to this hierarchical kind of relationship. A God who has power to persevere as a companion through all of our struggles, which brings us to our deepest hope, because our deepest hope is not to have a pain-free life, but that we grow to be like God and have the strength of love to share with God the burdens of others, the caregiving thing, and to persevere with grace as a companion to the companion in God's suffering love. Well, that's saying a lot, but that's what I believe is how we are empowered through Christ. And this, he goes on to say to his friend, that we grow into the likeness of Christ and live in grace in the midst of the best and the worst, the contrary theme this summer, and that is God's passion. God's passion is not to remove every hardship, which is the fix-it tendency we have, or the repression, but to remove every obstacle to living a life in grace, which is the healing journey. And he goes on to talk about the cross, that the ultimate defeat that the cross seemed to be was turned into the doorway to salvation, grace, and new life for those who pay attention. And I think that relates to the contemplative or seeking out your healing. One of the images I used in an earlier session was that I believe there are two powerful images from my two favorite women's stories in the New Testament, the woman at the well being one of them, this cast-off woman who needed to be encountered. Because a lot of us in grief or loss, pain, don't have energy. We don't even know what we need. We don't know what's wrong with us. And I love that story of this Samaritan woman who was encountered by this Jewish man who crossed all the boundaries and receives every part of her, and she runs out and tells all her friends, come and see this man who knows everything about me and receives me still. So she was empowered by that encounter. But the other part of that is that I think we're sometimes like that unnamed woman who was hemorrhaging for 12 years, and she knew she needed healing, and she knew if she could just get to Jesus and touch the hem of his garment, she would be healed, and she was. And you remember the story, Jesus said, woman, power has gone out of me. So I think another part of this for paying attention is that if we know there's something that we need to deal with, we keep listening to that and seeking out healers, and they're around. They're here at Holden. they're everywhere around us if we can hear and slow down long enough to name our issues to, as much as we can with the help of others. And he goes on to say that losses are opportunities for us to be recreated, or events that happen in our lives are really opportunities for new life. And then we become co-workers in God's task of recreating and redeeming the world and ourselves. Then he talks about this idea of praying our rage over innocent suffering that has been ours and that we see around us, that all is not whole. And this is where I think the power comes in, is that we are transformed, or our anger and our hurt, our loss is transformed into passion for bringing healing to other people who are feeling crushed by this world. That is not our power, but God's power in us. And the more we are aware, the deeper we know our pain, but also the deeper we know joy, which is that paradox. Who wants to walk deeper into pain? It's a very difficult journey, but that's also the depth of joy. Okay, any reactions or comments at this point on those concepts? Personal? Okay. That was the midpoint of the letter. This is a wonderfully long letter. Then he goes on to talk about Jesus' humanness of God, which exceeds our own, because we tend to love it all, our control issues. We're afraid that to be open to people and their hurt opens up our own fear and our own vulnerability. But Jesus, like in contrast of control, gave up all his advantage and has thrown his lot in with us, and his divinity is a divinity in us in the sense that we have an incredible depth of humanness to which we are called because the Spirit empowers us to discover that. Also, he talks about notions of power, that God's strength to love and to care, to give and forgive, is God's commitment to remain with us in life, death, and beyond death. Those John passages, that if you remain with me, you know, I will remain with you. We tend to want to fix it, God, however. That was what we had hoped for. That's what Israel was looking for, was a king God, a God who had earthly power that could fix things and make things right. But notions of power, by contrast, are that consolation and meaning out of our loss in terms of healing comes as we begin to ask questions, ageless questions that give us purpose. And healing does not come from answers. We don't carry our pain. This is as he's winding up the letter. He says, we don't carry our painful wounds in isolation. Our wounds are intimately connected with God's suffering in Christ. And loss and death leads us to struggle with our faith. So it's life and death, the contrary again. And then he ends with a note of realism that I think is ultimately more comforting when he says, pain doesn't go away soon, but one day your memories won't incapacitate you, you won't feel stuck, but instead you will strengthen and deepen as you grow as a person. And he even talks about contraries that have to be embraced in that journey, and that the last sentence of his letter is, out of my deepest pain has arisen my greatest joy. Okay, very quickly on to another article from Weavings, which was called When Prayer Encounters Pain. And maybe some of you know this woman. She's a Catholic sister who leads retreats in California. Her name is Flora Slauson Wellner, and I'd like to meet her after reading this article. This is on healing and community. She starts out the article by talking about unhealed sufferings and unintended hurts of individuals and communities that represent, she thinks, and are responsible for most of the perplexities and agony of this world. And the point of that in our personal lives is to become aware of our own woundedness and how we have been personally wounded by unintended hurts. That's part of the midlife journey, I guess, is coming to realize that your parents couldn't do everything for you. And we have been wounded, all of us have, no matter what our life story was. But when you realize that, the hopeful thing is that once you know you're wounded and you face your pain and keep naming it and dealing with it, you can let the healer come to you. And I think the more we don't recognize that, the more we won't even see that there are healers around us, and we'll put it off. We are afraid, though, to encounter the depths of our personal and communal pain. And sometimes she said in the article, we don't understand why the, oftentimes it seems the worst suffering can sometimes seem to heal quickly, whereas other forms of trivial pain can last a lifetime. And I'm keeping learning about that, how little things have to do with maybe a wounded childhood or little things that were not dealt with in my life or I haven't been healed of yet come out in enormous projections onto other things. And her point there is that unhealed suffering can affect and infect generations of a family for a lifetime. The sins of the fathers, as it says, and mothers are visited upon the third generation. So then she goes on to say that the point there is to look and attend and not rationalize with clarity and honesty the roots and meaning of our pain. That pain is really a warning signal. It's a caution light, a red and yellow light at the stop sign to stop and notice and attend to it. And that was what, going back to what I was mentioning about this first spiritual director that I'd met probably now 10 years ago, when I went to talk to her privately, I was dealing with issues that I thought I had dealt with 10 years ago, and here they were again, just recycled. They just looked a little different, but I realized it was the same old stuff. And that really scared me at that point in my life, because I thought, well, I'm 30 years old now, I should have taken care of all this. And her words of grace to me were just very gentle, simple words that attend to it and just listen to it. And another image I have for that is like a beach ball. You know how much energy we can spend trying to keep the beach ball under the water, and when it comes out then, eventually it'll come out with much more force than it needs to do in some displaced displaced place. Okay, then she goes on to talk about, in her categories, five major causes of suffering. The first one she calls the thorn in the flesh, which is illnesses, accidents, disabilities, natural disasters. 1 Corinthians 12 talks about our natural human condition of limitation and mortality. She calls this the thorn because we didn't ask for it, we don't want it, but that seems to be the condition of nature and of ourselves. And the Romans 8 passage where the universe is groaning and travailing, waiting for the great release. Even we are part of nature and nature is all groaning for that. As beings, we are deeply embedded in nature as well as spirit, and so we share. The second major cause of suffering, she says, is the hunger, she calls it. Suffering rising out of all forms of deprivation, emotional, spiritual, and physical. For instance, the agony of wounded, broken relationships, of loneliness, frustrated energies, loss of identity. Pain of those not loved enough, or when love means constriction and freedom. A third thing under the hunger, she says, is the agony of unexpressed gifts and powers. The Proverbs quote that hope deferred makes the heart sick. When we aren't into our energy or following our dreams, or we've had no way to find out what that is, we have a hunger within us for being complete persons. And finally, that nations and communities may have lived for generations with unfulfilled expectations. I was just talking to my sister not long ago. One of the interesting things I think about growing up in a family, so you think we grew up in different families, because she's 7 years younger than me, and the issues we were going through in our life, we perceived so differently because we played very different roles in the family, and she has totally different memories. So as we're growing older together, she'll say, well, do you remember that Dad always used to say that? I said, no, I never heard him say that. I missed that whole conversation. And one of the things she said about my father was that he wished he could have become a pastor. I had never heard that before. And she said, oh, yeah, he used to talk about, he grew up in a immigrant farm family in western Minnesota, and what you did then was you didn't need to be educated, you just quit working and went to World War II and came home and did the farm. And he didn't want to do that. He didn't fit into that family system. I think if he would have been more educated, he would have been a conscientious objector because he couldn't handle the war. He wanted to go on and do other things. He did not want to stay on the farm. And I think my dad really lived his whole life with a great deal of unfulfilled expectations, that the brokenness of his own journey, he just didn't find his path there. And that's what she calls the hunger. That is part of the deprivation of suffering. Okay, the third major category she talked about is the catapult, which she calls the symbol of a traumatic encounter with shock of evil and injustice that sooner or later affect us all. And that can be even distant. For instance, I was deeply affected by that Pan Am crash last Christmas. I didn't know anybody personally that was killed in that crash, but I think I was, as a mother, standing at that counter waiting for my son or daughter to come home from college and hearing that kind of news. I think we're affected deeply by tragedy and injustice and evil around us. And she said that the moment of injustice, whether intentional or impersonal, tends to engulf individuals and communities in chronic and acute depersonalization and destruction. Just one story on that, I've done some teaching and lead retreats in the prison system. And one particular day, I don't know where it came from, it wasn't even what we were talking about, and two guys in this group were both in Vietnam and had not talked about it for 20 years. And I realized that part of the reason they were incarcerated was because they were in Vietnam. They became drug addicted in Vietnam to anesthetize themselves. Obviously many, many complicated other things were going on. But I was sitting there then thinking right then about the ongoing war that is caused by being in a war. The way that victimized them, in a sense, in many ways, because of that war. Walter Brueggemann says, you know, we have all these busloads, plane loads of people that go to Central America so they can see suffering. And not to say people shouldn't do that, but he said we don't all have to go to Central America to see that or to see it in ourselves. That's part of our cover-up, he said. I thought that was an interesting perspective. But these tragedies are not willed by God, the God we know, and it's very dangerous theology to say that fragmenting pain is sent by God. We don't know why. But that God's freedom and God's refusal to force us to change our choices is the mystery of these forms of pain. Rather, God works far more with us in longing that we do the things that need to be done, that the hungry be fed, that the thorn be removed, and the catapult be deflected, that our healing work in the world is to address these issues. Fourth major category of suffering is the cross, which was God's invitation to us to enter, to share, and to lift the burdens of others. We also have a freedom to reject that cross, any cross, versus all these. In other words, the last two categories are not the same as the first three. The first three I've just talked about, we are born into the world and discover them. The last two are invitations by God. One is the cross. But if we accept that invitation, then we are initiating in continuing into long-term healing relationships. We are entering into the pain of another person, entering into our own pain, entering into long-term community. And as we enter with loving redemptive power, we do it not alone. We are a member of Christ's whole body, which is why I believe so much in the idea of healing community. She also had another little sub-point in that section about discerning whether if it's our cross or not. You know, a lot of us have grown up with some, I think, erroneous theology that we have to bear a certain kind of cross and it's not leading to any joy at all. And so one of her measurements for discernment is if it's joy and if it's renewing and energizing, it has increased authenticity with us. Otherwise, God may be calling us to a new commitment, which is another way of saying to listen to your own issues and process them or find healing for them is a way of finding your joy in that idea of the cross. And finally, the birth, she calls it, which is suffering that is caused by awakening and stretching will bring rebirth within our deepest selves. And those are the pain of endings and new beginnings, of letting go, taking hold. And she makes the analogy that in birth, we bring forth our deepest wounds, and then the deepest powers for healing and release are there. In birth, we explore, we're choosing, we're asserting, we're reaching out, moving out, and that's the very pain of creation in which God shares within us. So the distinction, I think, between the first three and the last two are very interesting distinctions. Then she talks in the final part of the article about our awareness that so often when pain is so chronic, we're not even aware we're suffering. A lot of us can be stuck in systems or whatever, and we don't even know that what we're really doing is suffering. We wouldn't have to if we become aware of what it is. That we realize we are carrying unhealed wounds in us. So part of this journey is to discern hidden pain, and I think we need help in doing that. We need each other. And it comes in many, many forms, as we were talking about at the very beginning. We need to face the reality of our suffering to bring pain to prayer. And gentle self-inquiry and honesty will, number one, either change or traumatize in our personal life. What is a change or a trauma we've had? I think Holden is, no matter how long you're here, is it time to reflect a little bit on that? Because this is a place apart, and what changes am I dealing with, or have I been traumatized? Or are there some changes in my immediate community, family, work, neighbors, church, etc.? Okay, just to wrap up what her article was saying then, in addition to those ways, is asking yourself if you're not satisfied or you're not feeling adequate, that you may be dealing with unhealed memories or inadequate bonding or some unfulfillment in your life. Your body, what does it say about your feelings? That our bodies are truth tellers, and sometimes we're carrying unfaced burdens of pain from our personal lives. Learning to listen to our bodies is an essential spiritual discipline and intrinsic part of healing prayer, and finally our dreams. Our wounds are never wasted, and this is the hopeful note, that after release from points of suffering as we go along the journey, we can look at our scars and issues from the past as signs of our woundedness that have been healed, and they become the very sources of our love and life. So, any reflections on those ideas? Would you like to share? I thought it was an interesting framework of ways to look at suffering and the different kinds of suffering.
I like the point on stretching. Pain and grief will help you to stretch and learn more about God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking about the second article, and she talks about now that I remember, I'm so tired. But anyway, what I was thinking is that, I mean, the combination of the relationship between kind of spirituality and, of course, you know, psychology, because what I'm dealing with right now, and not only in terms of grieving, but in general, is this combination of this urge of being one or whole or whatever, this strive that we have to do that. And I was making some kind of connection with my background in terms of seeing, you know, the move that and I don't think it's over there too, but we come from a strong patriarchal tradition, and it had negative aspects, of course. But if you think of the family, or the big clan, so to speak, where if you had a problem, you would go to your aunt, to your grandmother, your sister, your cousins, and I've experienced some of that. And so that's healing there, and that's helping one another. But if it's framed that way, it's acceptable. And nowadays, it's not even acceptable that way, and it's less acceptable to ask for help somebody that you don't know. And the thought that I had with this just urge to be one and whole and things like that has to do with trust. I mean, trust that, I'm confused. I'm trying to put my thoughts together, but I think that on a personal level, I trust people maybe too much, and I get hurt very much by that. And yet, I mean, I think that I don't trust. I mean, my issue is trusting people who are going to be there for me, and there's this drive to get someplace with somebody. I mean a friend. But since our family, as I said, we are wounded. I mean, in our families of origin, we experienced at one point some kind of wound, abuses, or whatever. So it gets more and more difficult to really trust other people because we don't trust ourselves, we don't trust our mm-hmm. parents or our families, we don't trust friends, we don't trust congregations. And as I was reflecting on my congregation too, and I was thinking, I know people there who are very nice and everything, but they are not able to really, I don't think they would support me, and I don't think I would be able to support them because there isn't that basic trust, like, let's open up and see who is down there. And I don't know why. I mean, I guess trust is the key word, because I cannot really explain it in a different way.
What comes to my mind, if I hear you right, is that I think it's an act of trusting the truth within you as part of God's creation, and that we sometimes look to, like you were saying, families, congregations, we think to look to all these places, and we may not find it there, but I believe very much, I've been hearing Nancy Searles this week talk about color, that in color is in all of creation. And I believe that it's an act of trusting your own self and your own process, and that trusting there are, I say angels, when I used to bring my angel these last sessions, there are angels there for you. and being praying and asking God to help them come to you, or help you see them, or notice them, and they will come in very unexpected places. I really believe that. Is that speaking somewhat to what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I'm processing thoughts more than anything else. It has helped me a lot to trust God, trust my, you know, myself, and trust God, and see God as a somebody so loving that I can, you know, crawl on his or her lap. And it has been a very dear image for me that since I've never had that from my mother, from my own mother, and I have that, you know, I experienced that a lot, that just crawling in God's lap and just sit there and be protected, something that I don't even experience with my friends, because that's too vulnerable. And sometimes I can be vulnerable with God, maybe because I don't see him or her. I mean, it's such an idea or an ideal that it's easier to have an image like that than to experience it in real life with friends. I'm not talking about, you know, lover or husband or wife, because at this point I can't. But.
And I believe very much in that intuitive process as well, when you feel, oh, maybe I should go here, or maybe there's something here for me, or you meet people and to draw people out and to just follow your inner leading that is leading you to your own healing, because I think the human spirit is amazingly oriented toward healing. Mm-hmm. Other comments?
Mm-hmm. Can I make one comment?
Please.
When we address, I'll come up one row here. One thing we do with God's love is remove ourselves from what other people have given us and transplant the need for caring, like you're crawling up into God's lap and feeling nurtured, and put that onto God. We are still going out of ourselves to find God's love and nurturing. This is something that I feel the church has done in personifying God, that God has a lap. What we need to work with is to realize that God's love and God's lap is within our own heart, that it is within us. And the nurturing that we say, well, we've got to go over here and ask for it and crawl up in God's lap over here, that this is an issue of child that is within us, and that God's love and the nurturing is something that we cannot ask anybody else to do for us. That it is something that is within us as we free the pain and the joy of child. And that the lap we crawl into is within us. And then at that point, when we do not need, what you're saying is you need God. If you need God, it becomes something very earthbound, very structured, very much within controlling. Well, if I need God, I will go and get God. Or I need to talk to my aunt, or I need to talk to my mother. It's when it passes need, which fulfills basic stuff within us, and we can feel that within us and live within the joy. It's something that sounds so esoteric, and actually it's something that we all are working with. And as you move it to God and over, you know, something over there, and the next step is not a very large one, but it provides the totality that you're looking for. The total person is one who is within.
I don't understand. I think I understand what you're trying to say, but I'd like to some clarification about what you're saying, that if we are in need of God.
God, of course.
Sorry?
Of course, the love of God, we are very much in need of.
But I hear as a negative thing when you say, oh, if I need God, it's like needing my mother, my sister.
Oh, no. But that's, generally in life, that's where we begin. We need other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we move farther into spirituality, we realize that the needs now are God's love and God's caring. And that God is always with us. And that all we need to do is be still. And God's love is then manifested. It is always with us. No, they feel different. And we begin by going to other people as a child.
Mm-hmm. And so spiritual directors, mentors, people, is where we begin also to find the God within us. Is that what you're saying?
And answer some of the childhood needs,
mm-hmm.
so that God does not become an answer to a childhood need.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might put it a little more succinctly.
But again, you have to go there. You have to go through the growing.
Absolutely.
Process. I mean, I feel that I'm just dying on that.
Many people never
acknowledge the fact that I had a child within myself, you know. So you're kidding, I'm an adult, and now it's like doing that growing and accepting of that. And at that point, I can really even feel comfortable about, you know, crawling into God's lap. I mean, I like it. I think it's a neat concept for myself. Not because I'm a child, but because I'm recognizing the child inside of me.
Exactly.
And I have, by contrast, I have been more able to accept the fact that, you know, that I'm an adult and I have adult needs and an adult body, and yet I might have also I would say care, nurturing, love.
Yes.
That everyone.
You're in process then. You're in process, and it's exciting because many never enter the process. Never even get beyond drawing from the community what they need, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a whole culture full of people doing that.
But I have to, just to go back to the topic here today, I had to acknowledge and start grieving for my losses, for my lost childhood. You know, I never grieved really my father's death. You know, I realized later on I never did. My mother's coming to visit me, by the way, in a month, and she's still grieving after my father's death, which I happened. Three, and I'm going to be living with her a lot. So I might better read some books and try to do some stress management. I was thinking before, it's going to be tough for me. But I never acknowledged that, and I never grieved. And the support group, I mean, the support that I got is that when I started talking about that, some people, you know, even though they weren't aware, it was a really nice drawing experience that I did with some of my friends, because it was just like, oh, that sounds, that's great, okay. I mean, and we started talking about that, but it wasn't in a very structured, it was like, I had the courage to say, well, you know, I feel that way, or I feel really, you know, bad or in pain or whatever. And it's true that once you start talking, you know, but I have the tendency to push it. Mm-hmm. Like on the beach, the moon.
Thank you.
Yes.
One more back to the topic. I really appreciate the third suffering type of thinking of the long distance and that we have words to make that legitimate. I'm thinking of being somewhat fresh out of college and how many afternoons we spent on the Ollie North business. And instead of pain, it really turned, or suffering, which it's so far away, we can't suffer about it, but it turned to cynicism and real sourness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can accept that it is, it is hurtful to be disillusioned like that, that's a lot more healthy than just complaining about it.
Thank you.